Welcome. I'm David Goa, the director of the Chester Ronning Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life at the Augustana campus of the University of Alberta. And we're delighted today to have the second of the Augustana Distinguished Lectures for this fall, given by Dr. Clint Curl. The first one was last evening at Augustana, on Rethinking the Enlightenment, New Directions for International Human Rights. And this afternoon, he is going to speak on the most important book I have ever read, a quote from John Humphreys, John Humphrey, Henri Bergson, and International Human Rights. I'm pleased that we are co-sponsoring this with the John Humphrey Center for Peace and Human Rights. And delighted that Clint has come to be with us. Clint Curl has degrees in theology, legal studies, political philosophy. He is a pastor of a Wesleyan Methodist church in Ottawa, teaches in the law faculty on human rights at Carleton University, and is the executive director of the World Hope International Canada, a relief and development organization. His academic interests are focused on international human rights as a site for the intersection of faith, law, and politics in our world. And his first book, Humanité, John Humphrey's Alternative Account of Human Rights, was published by the University of Toronto just 6 months ago, about. So I'm delighted that he's here to speak with us and think with us about the extraordinary gift, it seems to me, of the late 20th century or the last half of the 20th century, human rights legislation, and to help us think about how it can be moved to what I often call its second generation. Dr. Curl.
First of all, let me say thank you to the Chester Ronning Center and the John Humphrey Center for inviting me here this afternoon. My theme is John Humphrey, the chief drafter of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Now, for years, John Humphrey was really a shadowy figure on the edge of the contemporary human rights movement. This was in part due to the claim the French government made that one of their diplomats, a man named René Cassin, was the chief drafter of the declaration, and in part due to Humphrey's typically Canadian self-effacing reserve. When asked, Humphrey would always insist that the Universal Declaration was the result of a dynamic process, that the UN wrote the Universal Declaration. The committees wrote it. But the authorship of the first draft of the Declaration is, in my mind, beyond dispute. Here's what happened. In 1946, Humphrey was hired by the UN to be the director of the Human Rights Division Secretariat. Essentially, he was the chief bureaucrat at the service of the diplomats on the Human Rights Commission. The Human Rights Commission had their first meeting in 1947, and in this meeting, it appointed a subcommittee to prepare a first draft of what would become the Declaration. The drafting subcommittee, which eventually increased to 8 members, initially consisted of but 3. They were Eleanor Roosevelt, as chair of the Human Rights Commission, the Chinese diplomat Peng Chuncheng, known as P.C. Chang by everyone on the commission, and Charles Malik of Lebanon. The subcommittee held its first meeting in Eleanor Roosevelt's apartment, and in retrospect, it was really quite a comical affair. It turns out that Malik was a committed neo-Thomist, and Chang was a Confucian scholar who had studied with John Dewey and deeply imbibed his pragmatic philosophy, and the two could agree on nothing. There's a charming quote from Eleanor Roosevelt's memoirs I'll read to you. She writes, "It was decided that Dr. Humphrey would prepare the preliminary draft, and as we settled down over the teacups, One of them made a remark with philosophical implications, and a heated discussion ensued. Dr. Chang was a pluralist and held forth in charming fashion on the proposition that there is more than one kind of ultimate reality. The declaration, he said, should reflect more than simply Western ideas, and Dr. Humphrey would have to be eclectic in his approach. His remark, though addressed to Dr. Humphrey, was really directed at Dr. Malik, from whom it drew a prompt retort as he expounded at some length the philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas. Dr. Humphrey joined enthusiastically in this discussion, and I remember that at one point, Dr. Chang suggested that the Secretariat might well spend a few months studying the fundamentals of Confucianism. Well, the meeting went all day, and it resulted in a single resolution, that John Humphrey was to prepare a draft declaration of human rights. So, how was it that René Cassin took the credit for drafting the declaration? Well, here's what happened. Humphrey, you know, went out, gathered recommendations from as wide a circle as he could manage, and duly produced a draft declaration of human rights and submitted it to the drafting subcommittee. This subcommittee, which now was 8 members at the request of the Soviet Union, convened again in June 1947 to discuss Humphrey's draft. A working group consisting of delegates from France, Lebanon, and the UK was given the task of rearranging the articles in Humphrey's draft in light of the committee's discussions. The working group, in turn, assigned the French delegate, Cassin, the task of preparing this revised draft. And he did this literally over the weekend with the help of an officer from the Division of Human Rights named Émile Giraud, who, incidentally, was Humphrey's assistant. And apart from reorganizing the articles, the only significant change that Cassin made was to Article 1, where he inserted these words: "All men are brothers. Being endowed with reason, members of one family, they are free and possess equal dignity and rights." Humphrey later complained bitterly about this addition, noting that it created, and I quote, "much difficulty at the second session of the commission, and also led to difficulties with the commission on the status of women, which objected to its language. The philosophical concepts contained in the article raised almost endless controversy and debate, especially in the General Assembly." This revision of Humphrey's draft in Cassin's handwriting is what caused all the mischief. Because on the 10th anniversary of the declaration, the French government insisted that it be put in this fancy glass case in UN headquarters in New York. Everybody that came in, look at this handwritten declaration. The big sign, René Cassin, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And it quickly sort of, you know, everyone sort of gathered that Cassin was the original drafter. And then in 1968, which is the year that Cassin won the Nobel Prize, he actually claimed to have produced the initial draft of the declaration. Incidentally, years later, the original Humphrey handwritten draft of the Universal Declaration was found, and you'll never believe where it was found. It was found shoved in the back of a filing cabinet in McGill Law School behind some notes on Roman law that Humphrey had prepared for a class he taught, I guess it was in the 70s. It was found by a librarian named John Hobbins, and McGill, of course, was ecstatic they found this historical treasure, and they got their own fancy glass case, and they put it on display there, so touche. Now, despite all this nonsense, Humphrey was really on good terms with Cassin all the way through his UN tenure. I found this statement in an unpublished article Humphrey had written located in the John Humphrey Archives in McGill. "Professor Cassin's role in the drafting of the declaration was of the greatest importance. He became a kind of clearinghouse for ideas. And as the discussions went forward in the drafting committee, he produced a series of redrafts which reflected these discussions." I think the issue with regard to authorship was finally settled by Johann Morsink, the noted human rights historian, in 1999, after a careful comparison between Humphrey's draft and its many sources, he concluded, "Though he freely and frequently used the drafts he had with him, it seems equally clear that this draft was Humphrey's own creative mixture and molding of the options before him." Morsink continues, "We must conclude that this Humphrey draft is both the first and the basic draft of the Universal Declaration, first in time and basic, and that it became the basis for all further deletions and additions. The draft declaration then passed on to the Human Rights Commission. The commission held 187 meetings to a degree on the precise wording of the articles, and then the draft went on to the Economic and Social Council, who brought it before the UN's General Assembly without modification, but the General Assembly referred it to a subcommittee called the Third Committee. And this Third Committee devoted 81 meetings and entertained 168 resolutions regarding the draft, and then sent its report to the plenary session of the General Assembly on December 6, 1948. And by the way, I was fascinated to discover this in my research. The Canadian delegate on the Third Committee actually abstained from voting on the declaration, along with the Soviet bloc, South Africa, and Saudi Arabia. Humphrey, who had a real pugnacious streak, was furious when he found out. And Humphrey, of course, kept diaries of his time in the UN, and it makes very entertaining reading. Some very colorful comments. After a few hot phone calls and a very pointed memo, Canada grudgingly changed its position later in the plenary session of the General Assembly. And to our credit, we actually voted for the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Apparently, the Canadians saw sympathies to communism and the economic and social rights that Humphrey had included in the Declaration, which gives you an idea of how already in 1948, Cold War ideology was really polarizing the international scene. General Assembly adopted the Declaration on December 10th, 1948. And the truly remarkable thing, when you look at what was actually produced, and you look at Humphrey's original draft, is how the final product so closely resembled what Humphrey had originally written down. So, if we can trace this powerful document, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, back to one individual, a Canadian law professor, no less, then we can ask, what did this individual think he was doing? What was his idea of human rights? Now, Humphrey was always really reluctant to publicly discuss philosophy in his role at the UN, part because he thought it was inappropriate in his role as the head of the secretariat to discuss theory, and partly because he was worried that such discussions would bog everything down in intractable theoretical debates, just like Cassin's additions did. But fortunately for us, Humphrey kept a journal, a diary, all the time he was at the UN. And this was, of course, kept private. In fact, he wanted it destroyed at several points. Unfortunately, he didn't get around to that. And when he passed away, it was 1990, we didn't really know what was going to happen with this. A few people knew about it, but eventually, it was 1993, his estate released all of his papers. And these journals were published in a four-volume set entitled On the Edge of Greatness. And if we bring these private diaries into conversation with Humphrey's publications, his speeches, and his UN activity, we get a pretty clear picture of his idea of human rights. And for the remainder of our time together, I'd like to talk about Humphrey's vision of human rights, because I think it's highly original and potentially useful for us today. Humphrey published an article in 1945, before he got to the UN, which gives us some insight into his intellectual preoccupations immediately before taking up the cause of international human rights. The article I'm thinking of is entitled The Parent of Anarchy. Years later, he made a statement that he thought this was the best thing he'd ever written. So let me summarize it for you. It begins with the great fact of 1945, and you all know what that is. The bomb. Now that we have nuclear weapons, what the world needs, Humphrey said, is a supranational organization which can outlaw war. Government, he said, must be commensurate with the needs of government. And now that we know how to blow up the whole world, the urgent need is for worldwide governance. Now, formerly, looking back in history, under the Westphalian system of states, jurists such as Grotius, tried to accomplish this through a system of independent states under the precepts of natural law, which was universally binding due to its divine source and its inherent reasonableness. But as modernity continued along its course, the strong claims made by natural law were eventually subverted. We were left with legal positivism. But this restricted international law to international treaties and customs, which alone are insufficiently robust to make for effective international governance, at least of the kind that Humphrey envisioned. The destructive potential of nuclear weapons makes this situation insufferable. Humphrey's conclusion of the international situation in 1945 is really bleak. Consider the following quotation, which captures Humphrey's views immediately before entering the UN. He wrote, "The international society of the 20th century is almost wholly without elements of natural cohesion, although parts of humanity share common cultural and even religious traditions, and improvements in the means of communication and the growth of world commerce provides other unifying factors. The eccentric tendencies that are inherent in the modern state system are encouraged by differences in language, in religion, and political traditions that are still deep and fundamental. And to these, the 20th century has added differences in economic theory and practice that are equally profound. Even more fundamental obstacles to world union are the deeply embedded and powerful vested interests which control the various national governments." So what's needed, Humphrey concluded, is some form of international governance that recognizes the individual, not just the state. But with the death of natural law theory, we don't even have a conceptual framework in which to pursue that end. As you can see, Humphrey was no starry-eyed idealist. The Enlightenment compelled the international legal community to abandon all notions of universal natural law, which at least conceptually set limits on nation states, but then left us without a replacement. To summarize Humphrey, "We used to have God, and now all we've got is Hans Kelsen." It's a problem. We need universal politics of the individual, but the inadequacy of both natural law and legal positivism to provide such a politics was Humphrey's central idea in his early years. International human rights were the solution he eventually found. Now recall the initial drafting committee I described, and the one that met in Roosevelt's apartment. I found it helpful to conceptually position Humphrey between Charles Malik on the one hand and P.C. Chang on the other. In Humphrey's own words from his journals, "In intellectual stature, Chang and Malik dominated the Human Rights Commission and were both to play significant roles. They were both scholarly men. But Chang was a pragmatist. He called himself a pluralist, whereas Malik believed that Thomist philosophy provided the answers to most questions. His thinking was apt to carry him to rigid conclusions." So at the very beginning of this drafting process, Humphrey was confronted with two formidable but incompatible approaches to human rights. On the one hand, Dr. Chang proposed a combination of American pragmatism and Chinese Confucianism, which regarded the Declaration as just a practical contract on how to get along together. The Declaration would, in this view, be a-philosophical, even casuistic. But on the other hand, Malik insisted that the Declaration must proceed from first principles, and he offered a sophisticated version of neo-Thomism as the philosophical foundation of the Declaration. We know from his journals that Humphrey was keenly uncomfortable with natural law approaches to human rights because they rested on an essentialist philosophy that he felt was just inappropriate for pluralistic contexts, such as the international scene in 1948. The strong claims made by neo-Thomism engendered intractable debates which threatened to paralyze the international human rights movement. And while he was intellectually closer to Dr. Chang than to Dr. Malik, Humphrey recognized the need for something more than pragmatism, to sustain and guide the Human Rights Project. What then was Humphrey's vision of rights? And here we turn to his journals in earnest. Humphrey began his journals when the draft declaration had already gone through the Commission on Human Rights and was with the Economic and Social Council. Humphrey was an avid reader of academic and classical texts. And in his journals, Humphrey devotes most of the space to analyzing what he was reading in light of his commitment to human rights. Between August 1948 and December 1949, Humphrey read and completed works by, and you won't believe this, works by André Gide, Simone de Beauvoir, Gabriel Roy, René Bajavel, Pierre Lecomte de Nouy, Carlo Levi, Jean-Paul Sartre, Jean Cocteau, Albert Camus, Paul Valéry, Maxime Gorky, Henri Bergson, Maurice Duhon, A. Parege Diaz Canseco, Alexander Pushkin, Leo Tolstoy, Guy de Maupassant, Barbara Ward, Hugh MacLennan, Bertrand Russell, Kenneth Graham, Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Macaulay, William Shakespeare, a little break there, William James, Gustave Morph, Marcel Aime, Winston Churchill, Catherine Mansfield, Charles Morgan, E.M. Forster, Henri Troyat, Georges Santayana, Lord Acton, and Niccolo Machiavelli. I have no idea how he had time to read all that, given his insane work schedule and the endless round of diplomatic cocktail parties at the UN. But at any rate, judging from Humphrey's journals, it was during this 17-month extended manic episode that Humphrey's own philosophy of human rights took shape. And of all the authors that I cited, all those that were recorded in the journals, Henri Bergson receives far and away the most attention. Within this 17-month period, Humphrey read not just one book by Bergson, but everything Bergson wrote, as well as Bertrand Russell's critique of Bergson in the History of Western Philosophy. And on December 24, 1948, that's 2 weeks after the Universal Declaration was finally ratified, Humphrey wrote in his journals, "Bergson's Two Sources of Morality and Religion is perhaps one of the most important books that I have ever read." Why? Well, in Bergson, Humphrey had found a satisfying way to justify and understand universal human rights, a way that was neither neo-Thomist, but more than pragmatic. The story of how Humphrey became interested in Bergson is really fascinating. Recall that Humphrey entered the Human Rights Project really on a tragic note. I mean, natural law provided a basis for universal peace, but it was untenable in pluralistic contexts. But positive law on its own was not sufficiently potent to restrain governmental powers, which were prone to corruption from running roughshod over individuals. And in an irascible moment, on September 8, 1948, Humphrey journaled, "What we need is something like the Christian morality without the Tommy rot." Shortly after recording this elegant thought, Humphrey made the acquaintance of French-Canadian novelist Gabriel Roy. And they hit it off so well, they got into a theological debate. And on parting, Roy recommended a book to Humphrey, L'Homme et sa Destinée, or Human Destiny, by Pierre Lecomte de Nouy. Now, Lecomte de Nouy argued that evolutionary theory required the hypothesis of God. He suggested that the destination of human evolution is in a direction away from animal existence, away from nature and from necessity, and toward human liberty. And this movement occurs in history through the example of great moral leaders. Lecomte de Nouy proposed that human progress must be measured not by scientific advancement, but rather by what he called the development of human dignity, which is the supreme goal of humanity. It's not difficult to see how universal human rights could be regarded as a step up the evolutionary ladder away from nature and toward freedom. And while Humphrey was obviously moved by this argument, impressed by it, he was also suspicious of it, and that it seemed to involve a loss of individuality. I mean, everything here was humanity as a species. Where's the I? Where's the individual? And with this, Humphrey turned to the philosopher Henry Bergson, to whom Le Comte de Noailles specifically referred. Bergson's mature philosophy is best expressed in his final book, The Two Sources of Morality and Religion, the book which Humphrey avowed was so important. Now, we don't read Henry Bergson very much anymore, so let me give you Bergson in a nutshell. There are two great moral forces at work in human society. And these two great moral forces lead society in two different directions. On the one hand, human intelligence and instinct lead to what Bergson called diversely qualified workers who mutually supplement one another. And this aspect of society, which really corresponds to the society of the social insects like bees or ants, Bergson called closed society. And the essential character of the closed society is to include at any moment a certain number of individuals and to exclude others. He writes, "The closed society is that whose members hold together, caring nothing for the rest of humanity, on the alert for attack or defense, bound in fact to a perpetual readiness for battle. Such is human society fresh from the hands of nature. Man was made for this society as the ant heap was, as the ant was made for the ant heap." I think Carl Schmitt's vision of human society in his book, The Concept of the Political, is the perfect philosophy of the closed society. And Germany's National Socialism in 1938 is the perfect example of a closed society. It's summed up tidily by Adolf Hitler's famous words, "Right is what is good for the German people." The morality of social pressure, a morality that is concerned with the survival of the group. But on the other hand, Bergson says, there's another moral force at work in human society. History reveals exceptional people who have brought forth something altogether different. The sages of ancient Greece, prophets of Israel, the Arahants of Buddhism, and the saints of Christianity. And this morality, it's different in kind from the social obligation of the closed society. I mean, social obligation finds its best expression in impersonal laws. But this second morality, or what Bergson called absolute morality, open morality, it's best expressed in a human being, which is incarnated, in a privileged moral virtuoso who becomes an example, becomes infectious. And while social obligation is rooted in nature, absolute morality is known through an intuition of something transcendent, something spiritual. The morality of society, of the first morality, is really an obligation, it's a pressure. The morality of the saints is an attraction or an aspiration. And it's this second moral force which is universal in scope, and which is associated with what Bergson called the open society. So we can think of examples. I mean, think of the moral authority of the Dalai Lama. Think of the moral authority of someone like Mother Teresa, someone like Gandhi, Jesus. Well, we have many examples. Now, closed morality is essential for the existence of any community. It's boundaries for the community, you can't avoid it. But in a healthy society, there's a dialectic circle between open and closed moralities. We see the interplay between the two sources of morality in the development of the idea of justice. From the end of social obligation, justice is all about making rules for the equal valuation of objects. It's about keeping order in society. And this justice is entirely arithmetic in its orientation. Even once extended to persons, this justice retains its arithmetic quality. It's linked inseparably to social order, keeping the peace, holding the thing together. But at a point in human development, justice began to be viewed in a way that affirmed, and I'll quote Bergson, "the incommensurability of the person with any values whatsoever, and the inviolability of right." This is nothing less than the inbreaking of an entirely new morality, an open morality. But the language used to express this new justice remains the same. They share a common lexicon, affecting a kind of retroactive change in the concept, such that we do not even clearly see the novelty of the creation of absolute justice and the absorption of relative or closed justice into it. Now, what's this got to do with human rights? Well, for Bergson, universal human rights are the primary example of this dialectic circle between open and closed justice. They represent a shift from relative closed justice, the justice that's concerned with social order, with preserving the community, to absolute open justice, the justice that's fully universal. They're a dramatic leap in the evolution of humanity. However, the necessity of writing things down in legal texts requires a kind of translation back into closed justice. So there's a kind of a gap between the legal text and the reality to which the legal text points. And the primary function of such texts is to transform citizens, to orient them away from resistance to the enemy and toward a universal openness to the other. And while the legal texts are embraced, they're frankly regarded as limited and provisional and ultimately unsatisfactory. So says Henry Bergson. Now, back to John Humphrey. How did Bergson's philosophy inform Humphrey's view of human rights? Well, in 1947, prior to reading Bergson, Humphrey spoke of human rights simply as an attempt at, and this is a quote, supranational supervision of the relations between the state and its citizens. And beyond this general assertion, Humphrey didn't venture. But in June 4th, 1949, after reading Bergson, Humphrey delivered an address at the annual dinner of the Canadian Institute for International Affairs in Montreal, which placed human rights in a Bergsonian framework. In his introductory remarks to this speech, Humphrey makes this explicit, and I quote, Humphrey says, "The great French philosopher, the late Professor Henry Bergson, has said that creative evolution consists in all its manifestations of a movement toward greater and greater freedom and the emancipation of the human mind and will." Humphrey proceeded to place the Universal Declaration in this context. He suggested the economic, social, and cultural rights enshrined in the Declaration are the next step in the evolutionary development of humankind. But the real significance of the Declaration is found in its universality. The Declaration transcends nations, unites all people together under a law higher than the sovereignty of Leviathan. Humphrey concluded, "We know, too, that we have on our side all the best men and women anywhere, whatever their race, language, or religion, and we know that we are in the full stream of creative evolution." Wow. So what Bergson did is he offered Humphrey kind of a framework in which to place human rights. Humankind was evolving in the direction of liberty. And this great narrative, this dynamic process, is presently being made manifest in the UN's Human Rights Project. Since this evolutionary process is universal in scope, and all people participate in it by virtue of their humanity, human rights are universal. But to say this is not to provide a foundation for rights, as is given in neo-Thomism. It does not ground fluctuating human laws in eternal, static, capital T, essential truth. In fact, the dynamic is privileged over the static. Human rights are universal because they are a genuine expression of the evolutionary process that englobes all of humanity. In Bergson, Humphrey found a way to conceive of human rights that was neither Thomist nor simply pragmatic. Glimmers of Bergson are easily discernible in Humphrey from this point onward. In particular, the theme of dynamism plays a very large part in Humphrey's subsequent writings. On December 9, 1961, Humphrey delivered a speech to the United Nations Association in Hamilton, Ontario. He describes human rights as a new international morality, and again I quote, "The Universal Declaration of Human Rights and in general, the human rights program of the United Nations have been one of the great catalysts of our time. Perhaps catalyst is not the right word, because a catalyst is something which helps bring about a change without changing itself. And one of the most significant characteristics of this program is that not only does it bring about change, but it is itself changing all the time." Indeed, the very concept of human rights, which is a dynamic and not a static concept, is changing every day. And you will find, particularly in the language of the two draft covenants, new content, new rights, the protection of which had no place in the Magna Carta or the French Declaration of the Rights of Man. And if mankind proves itself mature and wise enough to devise some system for protecting the most essential of all rights, the right to life, we may expect to move on to ever-widening horizons in the recognition of human personality and human dignity. So the result is that for Humphrey, on the one hand, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a text derived from great moral leaders, in all likelihood the many moral heroes which the Second World War revealed, and which finds new incarnations in people like Martin Luther King Jr., Nelson Mandela, Aung San Suu Kyi, and as such represents a call to imitate these great souls. But on the other hand, the Declaration partakes of closed justice, is expressed in an impersonal quasi-legal instrument, and concerns itself with the practical terms of survival for each nation which is a signatory to it. So, agreement on rights is anchored not in the natural operation of a free intellect which establishes a universal essence, but rather in a universal intuition, an intuition of spirit. Because the discourse springing from this intuition of human dignity is always imperfect and provisional, because something is lost in translation from open to closed morality, as we write it down in legal texts, debates regarding rights are inevitable and, in fact, even healthy. These debates and conflicts are an invitation to find a better way to discursively represent our common humanity. Every account of rights, every statement of rights for Humphrey must remain flexible, must remain dynamic, ever open to correspond more closely to the contours of the reality which intuition reveals. And in this light, Humphrey affirms that human rights are quite properly expressed as a declaration and not as positive law. Because this invites creative, positive translations of the intuition of human dignity into manifold, culturally appropriate forms, at one level controlling and even policing positive law with a standard which it must meet, yet encouraging a myriad of symbolic constructions in this task. Furthermore, human rights framed as a declaration invites reflection on the relationship between the laws we make and what it means to be human. It opens up philosophical anthropology in the public realm. Now, so what? What's the practical import of all of this? Well, I think it does some very good things for us. Recall Humphrey's perplexity in 1945 as he contemplated the international scene. I mean, we need something stronger than mere positive law to create the bonds of political friendship that are necessary for world peace. But as soon as we try to articulate these bonds, we're confounded by a pluralism of philosophies and theologies of human rights. That's just as true now as it was then, perhaps even more true now. So what have we done? Well, the human rights community of today has largely gone in for an overlapping consensus approach, where people have different and potentially incompatible philosophical and religious reasons for human rights that they find compelling privately, and agreement is sought not at the theoretical level at all, but at the level of practice. But this approach has some pretty sharp limits, because as soon as rights are subject to challenge, either outwardly, where we're compelled to give reasons for human rights to persuade somebody, or else inwardly, perhaps when we encounter a claim for a new kind of right that we didn't anticipate, we necessarily refer to our particular philosophy of human rights to inform our practice. So an overlapping consensus can never be a silent consensus. We must find a way to discuss diverse theoretical perspectives on human rights and to learn from each other. And this, I think, is where Humphrey's view of rights is really helpful. Because not only does it provide us with a way of conceiving of universal human rights which is highly dynamic and flexible to context, But it gives us a language in which we can bring different conceptions of human rights together in dialogue. So let me give you a real-life historical example of this. You recall our discussions of Dr. Charles Malik, one of the initial members of the drafting committee that met in Eleanor Roosevelt's apartment. Well, Malik saw human rights in terms of neo-Thomist natural law. However, when he sought to articulate his position on rights in a pluralistic context, he translated himself into Bergsonian categories. So consider the following quotation from an address Malik gave to an audience of fellow Christians at the World Council of Churches on April 29, 1949. He said, "Either there is a common morality about man that can be codified and not only respected, but also actually observed under a rule of law, or we are on the verge of chaos. The proposed covenant is a symptom of the decay, not a cure. What can arrest and reverse the process of decay is certainly not international machinery, but the Spirit of God once again mightily breaking forth through the hearts of men. As in every crisis throughout the long record of human misery, the Church of Christ is the only real answer." Okay. Big round of applause from the fellow Christians. Now, contrast this with what Malik wrote in an article published just 2 months later in the United Nations Bulletin on July 1st, 1949. It starts very similarly. "Either there is a common morality about man that can be codified and not only respected but actually observed under a rule of law, or we're on the verge of chaos. The proposed covenant is a symptom of the decay, not a cure. What can arrest and reverse the process of decay is certainly not international machinery." Now here's where you have to listen. "But the creative spirit once again electing its own sons and daughters, both among men and women and nations. International activity is so hollow and pale without the mighty support of the highest spirit in concrete fact." Now, did you catch the changes? Notice the Bergsonian translation of the overtly Christian and Thomistic description of the human rights project that Malik gave to the World Council of Churches. The creative spirit is appealed to in lieu of the Spirit of God. The highest spirit in concrete fact replaces the Church of Christ. When Malik tried to foster pluralistic cooperation on rights on a basis which he himself could in good faith participate as a Christian and neo-Thomist, he reverted to Bergsonian categories. And I think that Bergson's framework, his vision of the open society and of a dialectic between open and closed moralities, it provides us a kind of a common language to think about human rights. It gives us a way to speak of the universality of rights, of the life of the spirit and its relationship to material concerns in a pluralistic and modern context without sacrificing the basic tenets of one's spiritual or philosophic tradition. I think we have here a language that's sufficiently flexible that pretty well everyone can come to the table and understand each other without sacrificing their religion, their philosophy, or their theoretical basis. So what we have here, and this is I think what Humphrey loved, is a language in which to mediate politics and transcendent concerns across cultures. So, this problem we have still, even more than Humphrey had it perhaps in 1949. And I think as we try to wend our way through the enduring tensions between the claim of universality that is in human rights and cultural particularities, I think we would do well to follow John Humphrey's lead. I think it holds particular promise when the human rights community bumps up against traditional religious communities. Quite often, I mean, we have a situation, particularly in Islamic societies, which are operating under Sharia law, you know, where human rights communities will go to such an Islamic society and say, "Okay, here's the declaration. You know, change yourself and adapt to this." Well, how is this perceived? Kind of looks like colonialism on the sneak, doesn't it? Well, is this the Crusades part two? But, you know, I think Bergson gives us another way to go here, right? We present human rights as a sort of the provisional expression of a dialectic we're in ourselves as we're trying to figure this out. And we intuit there's something to humans that's worth respecting. We intuit there's something sacred. And we try to write down that which is unwritable. Produce this declaration of human rights. But we regard this thing as, we regard this thing as on the move. And so we go to a traditional religious community and we ask, you know, this is our best shot at expressing concepts of mercy and justice. Tell us in your religion, how do you understand mercy and justice? How do you find your way between, you know, the realm of the spirit and the material physical realm? Wow. Every religion I know of has lots to say about these topics. And I think if we do this, we're into a very interesting conversation. And Bergson gives us a language in which to have that conversation. So, you know, no theory of rights is a cure-all. This certainly isn't either. I think that, you know, in drastic situations where there's, you know, dramatic and horrible abuses of human rights, appealing to Bergson's nuanced theory probably won't get you very far. But in situations where we need to dialogue and find a way to talk, I think Bergson, Humphrey's vision of rights was very helpful. So, perhaps we have some questions.
Question?
Yeah.
I understand you've taught at several educational institutions and so on. The UN asked all member countries to promote and publish the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, particularly in educational institutions. Are they in the institutions you taught at? Because I don't see them at this one.
Could you elaborate that a bit?
The UN Declaration asked all the countries to have their educational institutions promote and publish the declaration itself in their institutions.
Right.
Because I don't see any plaque on the wall here that says UN, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. When they could open Grant McEwen College, they did have it on the wall. Right?
Yeah.
The big letters.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
a couple of years later, it was taken down to put some pictures of donors on.
Isn't that telling?
Yes.
Well, that's pretty sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think I like human rights, actually. I think that's sort of, you know, that's really the only international normative framework we've got right now. You know, so whether you like it or not, that's what we got. If you're concerned about world peace, if you're concerned about human suffering.
Right, sir.
Yeah,
I was debating with Bishop John Shelby Spong on the radio one time, and talking about the divine scriptures, or sacred scriptures.
Yeah.
And I said, my position is that things like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is far more of a sacred text than anything in Leviticus. And he absolutely agreed with me, so.
There's something sacred to it.
There is.
Yeah, and I think that beautiful dialectic, I think there's something we need to recover. In recognizing the sacredness that's there, the legal documents point to, and that what we're involved in there is a dialectic between something that seems to be sacred and divine, and something that seems to be quite the opposite, something legal and very technical, right? And the human rights are best understood in terms of that. It's almost a hermeneutical circle. Yeah, sure. Well, that's really sad they don't post the Universal Declaration in the University of Albert. They should do it. Back to you. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much, Clint.
Again, I'd like to thank the John Humphrey Center for Renee has arrived for their work with us on this. I'll mention to you that this evening, Dr. Curl is giving the third lecture in this series under the title, which all of you no doubt will recognize immediately, What Has Constantinople to Do with New York? outside of the wall, I suppose. It's Byzantine Reflections on International Human Rights. He'll be elaborating on the religious dimension of the kind of thinking that he's been prompted to do in light of John Humphrey's considerations. That's going to be this evening at 7 o'clock at St. Herman's Church, which is at 9930 167th Street over in the West End. Thank you all for coming. Lovely to see you. Good afternoon.